From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Michael Wex is my guest this week. He is the author of the bestseller Born to Kvetch and Just Say Nu. His new book is How to Be a Mensch and Not a Schmuck. Michael Wex, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, hi, Gary. Thanks for having me on.
Tell us a little bit about, let's start with a little definition of mensch and schmuck.
Sure. Well, a mensch is a person, I guess what you would call a stand-up kind of person in English. The sort of person that can be relied on generally to do the right thing at the right time, not because anybody's watching, but just because it is the right thing. You know, it's an honest, upstanding, decent kind of person. So if, to give an example, if you had to go out and your friend was over and you ran out of the house and then realized, oh no, I left my wallet with all its money sitting on the kitchen table, you would know that with this mensch in the house, you needn't worry about him taking anything out of the wallet. Your wallet is safe there. And that's basically the kind of person a mensch is, someone who can, as I said, be relied on to do the right thing, even when nobody's looking, and even when there's no chance of getting caught.
But there is no such person. No.
Well,
it's an endangered species,
yeah, possibly. It's always been an endangered species. That's why it's such an ideal, of course. The trick is overcoming your more selfish impulses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a schmuck, of course, on the other hand, schmuck is a not very nice word in Yiddish for the male organ, that part of you that dysfuncts when you suffer from ED.
The organ and will play a solo immediately following the feature picture.
Exactly.
No, we can say penis on the air, I believe.
Yeah, well, that's nice. I'm glad. But, you know, the idea here is a schmuck behaves like what he is being called for. That is, completely self-centered, out only for itself, and not particularly interested in its effects on others as long as it gets what it wants.
Now, these are Yiddish words. There are a lot of Yiddish words for penis, if I'm not mistaken.
There are quite a few. I mean, there's actually not all that many. I mean, the well-known ones that have come into English, schmuck, putz, or putz in English, schlong, which I think Lenny Bruce had a lot to do with popularizing.
Yeah.
There are two or three others, but they're used frequently in Yiddish. Yiddish doesn't have a lot of vulgarisms of the type that English has. I mean, Yiddish can be very vulgar, but one of the things it doesn't do, firstly, is talk about female parts in anything other than an anatomical way.
Mm-hmm.
So they have no extended senses.
There's no insult. There's no corresponding insult.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you can speak of, you know, parts of a woman's body pejoratively, but you can't call a person by any of those names,
uh-huh,
the way you can in English. But the other thing that you don't have a lot of in Yiddish is the kind of casual blasphemy that you get in English and in most other European languages, as far as I'm aware. So, you know, if you hit your thumb with a hammer, it doesn't matter who you are or where you come from. If you're going to curse in English, you can be wearing a yarmulke and have a long, long beard, but what you're going to say is Jesus Christ. You know, to say Rabbi Akiva in similar circumstances, yeah, it just doesn't make sense. Yiddish doesn't have any of this, really. I mean, people who speak Yiddish are always calling on God, usually for deliverance from their children, but they're rarely, you know, because of the prohibitions in Jewish culture against using God's name, not just in vain, but even casually.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of sort of casual blasphemy, you know, goddamn whatever, basically doesn't exist in Yiddish. One of the things that stands in for it is the ritual of circumcision, which is the only indispensable ritual in the entire religion. It's the only thing you, especially if you're a man, that cannot be done without. And I think part of the reason that you get so much emphasis on vulgarisms and curses with schmuck and putz and things like that is that these are standing in for holier things that are so holy, so unmentionable, that you can't go near them. These become the stand-ins, and I think that's why they're so much more offensive in Yiddish than they are in English. You know, a word like schmuck or putz, I would never have used in front of my parents. and if they were living, I still wouldn't. And yeah. I'm in my 50s.
So you couldn't write this book until they were gone.
I did an interview with a Jewish radio show last week that would not say the complete name of the book.
I see.
They just said, How to Be a Mensch, and there's another part. They wouldn't touch it. And this was a show in English.
I think Billy Wilder had something to do with bringing the word mensch into common use. Would you agree?
He certainly helped, particularly in the film The Apartment, the old Jack Lemmon movie, where Jack Lemmon has been letting his apartment out to higher-ups in the insurance company where he works for them to have assignations with women to whom they aren't married. But this has led most of his neighbors to think that he is the number one party guy of all time, despite the fact that he's usually never in his apartment. And, of course, they all wonder how a schmendrick like this, how a jerk like this can do so well. After one of these women tries to commit suicide in his apartment, Jack Lemmon goes home. He finds the woman, Shirley MacLaine, in his apartment, doesn't know what to do. Fortunately, his next-door neighbor is a doctor, and it being New York City, is a Jewish doctor, who looks after Shirley MacLaine and then sits Jack Lemmon down and gives him a lecture about what it is to be a mensch. And this, for Jack Lemmon, or for his character, is the big turning point in the whole movie. He stops being oppressed by Fred McMurray and begins to stand up for himself and to look out for people other than himself. He's been totally selfish up until that point. So, yeah, I think Billy Wilder had a great deal to do with popularizing the notion among non-Jewish people.
So now, Michael Wex, you are going to be our next-door neighbor Jewish doctor, and you're going to inspire us all to be mensch.
I hope so. It would be nice.
What is the plural? Mention?
Mention, yeah.
Yeah, be mention. So what... Why did you choose to write your book? Was it, I imagine, the success of your other books? But why did you choose to write the book in this way, couching it in this language?
Partly because, of course, these terms are already known in English. You know, mensch and schmuck are understood by just about anybody in North America who speaks English as a first language. And it sounds a lot better than how to be a decent, moral, upstanding person instead of a jerk. But more than that, what triggered the whole thing was an editor had made a vague suggestion of, you know, why don't you write something about, what a mensch is. And I'd kind of dismissed the idea. I couldn't figure out what to do with it. And about a year and a half ago, when the Elliot Spitzer scandal broke, it suddenly dawned on me how to do it, because the thing that struck me about Spitzer was not so much that he'd been caught with a prostitute, which is not a good thing, but it's nothing terribly out of the ordinary. You know, for a politician to be embroiled in that kind of a scandal is not a huge thing. What struck me about Spitzer was when he was arrested, when the police came in, and they wanted to know who he was. I can understand that he didn't want to give his real name. It's an embarrassment for himself, his family, the entire state of New York. But rather than just give the usual pseudonym, you know, my name is John Smith, my name is John Doe or Richard Roe or whatever, he gave them the name of his best friend. who's, you know, clearly not a fictitious person, who's a guy that is supposed to, you know, love Elliot Spitzer and trust Elliot Spitzer, and Elliot Spitzer just sold this poor guy, whoever he is, down the river for, you know, solely to cover himself. And I started to think, like, what kind of person would do this?
A schmuck.
Exactly. Well, you know, and how do you get to be that big a schmuck? You know, you can't be born that jerky. You've got to work at it. And that's kind of what kicked it off. I'd seen not long before that an example of the exact opposite kind of behavior that would struck me so much. I thought, you know, I need to do something with this. It was just before Christmas, so I guess about four months before the Spitzer scandal. I happened to be in New York. I was walking down Fifth Avenue in the 50s, and I noticed there was a Hasidic man walking 20, 30 feet in front of me. And it struck me, I mean, this is not the sort of thing you often notice in New York, but from his clothing, I could tell he was from the same general type of Hasidic group as the one that I grew up in, which is not all that common in North America. So I was kind of, you know, struck to see one of these guys in New York. And he's walking down Fifth Avenue with a little girl about 11 or 12 years old, clearly his daughter. She's holding his hand. And as they get to a corner, it's around 50th or 51st Street, there's, a Salvation Army Santa Claus standing there. And he's ringing the bell, and, you know, people are putting dollar bills or whatever into the kettle. And the chosid reaches into his pocket, takes out some money, hands it to his daughter, who goes over and puts money into the Salvation Army Santa Claus's kettle. And I thought this was a great thing. You know, not only that they would give charity, but the idea of giving charity to something that's not going to be of any immediate benefit to his own community, that is giving just because it needs to be done. And I walked up to the guy, spoke to him in Yiddish. I said, you know, that was a great thing you did, and, you know, you're teaching your child such wonderful values, and it looks so good. And he just looked at me and said, well, he said, what else should I have done? You know, what was I supposed to do? And I thought the sort of dialectic between that and then what happened with Spitzer, and, you know, how maybe you can get to act more like the former than the latter, was, you know, at least worth a look in a book.
I agree. So how did you do it? How did you structure your book?
What I did was I sat down and began racking my brains to remember all the parts of the Talmud and starting with the Talmud and the Bible that prescribe selfless behavior, or tell you, you know, what is good behavior and what is bad behavior. And I very quickly came upon a couple of things that are, you know, very well known inside the tradition, that are both in the same Mishnaic tractate called Fathers, one of which says, in a place where nobody is a mensch, you should try to be a mensch. I'm translating loosely, of course. Mm-hmm. Which was one of the big ones. And the other was, there's a prescription that more or less, trying to think of the right word here, predates the golden rule as found in the Gospel of Matthew by a century or so, at any rate, attributed to a famous Talmudic rabbi called Hillel, who was asked, you know, he's asked, what is the sum and substance of the Torah? You know, I want to have the whole thing in one sentence, in a nutshell. And his answer is, what you don't like, what you hate for other people to do to you, don't do to other people. And I started working from this, thinking, well, how does this actually differ from the way it's formulated by Jesus, from, you know, do unto others? And is there any real difference?
And is there?
And, you know, started to look as, is there or isn't there? And decided, yes, there's a considerable difference. I mean, one that's not often or not always evident in practice. You know, do unto others or don't do unto others will both lead you to, you know, help an old lady across the road or...
Don't steal from somebody.
Yeah, stuff like that. It's when you get to, you know, things that are very basic, matters of food, clothing, shelter, alms to the poor, these tend to be the same everywhere, all the time. It's when you get past those very basic, you know, the minimal human needs, things people simply can't survive without. Then what happens, though, is you end up in a situation in which you, by following do unto others as you would have them do unto you, you're attributing to them the same way of looking at the world, the same preferences, the same cultural values as you have yourself. And this might not always be the case. What people like tends to differ very widely. And people aren't always sure what they like, but what everybody knows is what they don't like. You know, you turn on the television or go into any club and see a comedian. I don't think there's a comedian alive who has started a routine with, you know what I love.
You but know what I hate. Right.
Yeah, there are hundreds of them that start with, you know what I hate. Because, firstly, everybody knows what they hate. And chances are, if it's not something just totally off the wall, everybody else hates it too. You know what I hate? Bad traffic. You know what I hate? Television commercials. Things like that.
But, on the other hand, just to play devil's advocate
sure.
with you, I was in the... Target the other day,
mm-hmm.
and there's some kids walking around, and they were using foul language, much more foul than schmuck.
Yeah,
and without any, you know, they're not thinking, oh, it's rated G in here. That, in other words, that language doesn't offend them or bother them in any way. And in fact, it doesn't offend or bother me. But at the same time, I don't want to hear it. To that extent, it bothers me that I should be allowed to walk around without hearing a certain language. But since it doesn't bother them and it's not something they dislike, then how will you impart to them that they're not being mensches exactly?
I think the best way to do it, I have a teenage child of my own, so I know I'm treading on very thin ice here, is, you know, it's not the bad language per se. It's, you know, how would you like to have to listen to a bunch of crap that bugs you for no other reason than that the person who's spewing it out won't lower their voice? Because that's really, you're not telling them not to say that stuff.
Right, it's not the content, it's the...
You're just moment. Asking them to say it in such a way that you don't have to listen to it, which is a different thing. Again, I don't know if this is going to work with a kid.
Right.
You know, this is, you know, again, one of the criteria for being a mensch in Jewish tradition is that you are an adult.
But, of course, also in Jewish tradition, that would be age 13.
Age 13. Well, as it says in that wonderful book, Haikus for Jews, you know, today I am a man, tomorrow back to seventh grade. yeah, there are problems, but you had a whole educational system at one time designed to inculcate these values, at least on a fairly superficial, a day-to-day level, so that people would behave. And you had a, you know, it was a very different society in which age was privileged over youth, rather than the other way around, and also one in which corporal punishment was simply regarded as a learning aid.
Yeah, we're talking with Michael Wex, and his new book is called How to Be a Mensch, Not a Schmuck. Well, are you advocating that we return to corporal punishment then?
No, absolutely not. but,
well,
you know,
I mean, who should read your book? I mean, other than everybody, you know, should read it. But in other words, who will read it? Who do you think you will affect change with your book?
I would like to. I don't know that I'm naive enough to think that a single book by somebody, you know, who has not been canonized for the last couple of thousand years can have that effect. But it would, you know, I would hope that it at least leads people to think about what they do before they do it. You know, one of the things that we seem to be dealing with to a larger than usual extent in contemporary society is people who just don't consider anybody else, who can, you know, don't know the difference between what's coming to them, you know, between what's their due and what's their right. And if, you know, people could just back off a little bit. I know it sounds kind of cornball, but, you know, things like road rage, these kind of obsessive is probably the wrong word, but these almost clinical outbursts. You know, there were two in today's paper, Serena Williams and Kanye West.
Right.
People just going off in public in a way that, I mean, at one time, I mean, I'm not saying celebrities always behaved themselves, but at least Frank Sinatra had other people to beat people up for him.
Frank Sinatra never interrupted the Grammys to say, how can you give this award to Vaughn Monroe when Perry Como recorded such a
very... Exactly. I mean, the worst that I can ever think of like that is when Joseph Cotton is alleged to have read out Sonny Tuft's name as the winner of something and then just gone, Sonny Tuft?
What a great joke that became for about 40 years.
for years and years, poor Sonny Tuft. But this idea of just people having absolutely no control as long as they know that they're in a position or a place, no matter how temporary, there are no consequences.
I think I had the biggest problem I had with Kanye West's outburst, which was at the MTV Awards when he interrupted Taylor Swift. He interrupted her acceptance speech to say that the award should have gone to Beyonce. Well, the thing that bothered me the most was that, you know, mostly young people are watching that program. And so they're thinking, well, that's an acceptable way to express yourself, in the same way that a few years ago when, Jerry Springer was such a popular program in which people would hit each other with chairs and call each other sluts, and that was an acceptable way of negotiating an argument.
Yeah, and I do believe that continued exposure to this kind of thing does coarsen people. It makes... You know, it lowers your expectations, if nothing else, and makes it more difficult to behave properly and even to recognize proper behavior.
Well, Michael Wex, maybe you and I are just too old and we don't understand this is the way it is now.
Well, it could be, but again, you know, I've got a 14-year-old, and I notice that the stuff that upsets her at school is exactly the stuff that would have upset me. And again, her treatment of other people is not, you know, horribly out of line with the way, you know, a 14-year-old kid would have acted when we were growing up. You know, I think the real problem is the way adults behave, and because, you know, in part, as you just said, they're setting the bad example. And, you know, I'm not like some insane moralist or anything like that, but it's just this absolute lack of consideration. You know, you see it all over the internet where, of course, people think there are no consequences. So they will say the most horrible things and not understand why the people at the other end get upset by them. You know, it's this idea that other people's feelings, well, just aren't there. You know, they're not as real as your own. That I think is the one that needs to be countered in some way.
And so your book is in some part a prescription for healing this situation?
Yeah, I would hope so. Again, one of the examples I look at, I tried to draw on stuff that's not restricted to ancient Hebraic tomes, is the movie Groundhog Day, where, you know, you have quite explicitly this process of, you know, turning into a mensch, and it's not the term they use, but, you know, this menschification going on with the character played by Bill Murray, who starts off as just an absolute intolerable jerk, and by reliving the same day God knows how many thousands of times, I know in an early version of the script, he reads through the entire Punxsutawney Public Library one page a day before the movie is supposed to have ended. So he's there for quite a while.
And I guess, you know, the movie is in some way a religious movie because, I mean, who is holding him in this place?
Yeah, well, that, of course, is just never explained. But,
right.
Yeah, I think so. You know, there seems to be this, you know, this idea of, you know, fate playing itself out in his case there that, you know, I'm pretty sure has got to be deliberate on the part of Danny Rubin, who wrote the script. But, you know, again, you can see how as Bill Murray, or as the character, grows less and less self-absorbed, it's not just that he gets, that he's happier himself, but of course the people around him are also a lot happier. And it's, again, one of the things I try to talk about in the book is that even if you're not going to be happy, you know, there's no guarantee that being a decent person is going to make you happy. And quite often, it may, you know, doing the right thing may in fact lead to the opposite in terms of, you know, material satisfaction and things like that. But you can pretty much guarantee that somebody who is behaving in a mensch-like way will probably make the people around them a lot happier. And I think that by itself is worth something.
Well, the book is called How to Be a Mensch and Not a Schmuck, and the author is Michael Wex, and his previous books include Born to Kvetch and Just Say New, and I imagine there's something coming soon. Maybe you'll come back and talk about your next book with us.
I would love to. I'm working on a novel right now. So.
Oh, your first novel?
Actually be my third, but the two that I've done have been published only in Canada.
Well, we absolutely look forward to that, and thank you for spending some time with us today on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program, and I hope you'll come back again next week for another great show. In the meantime, check us out at our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And thanks to Michael Wex for being on our show and talking about his book, How to Be a Mensch and Not a Schmuck. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.